Good morning. Now, your notes this time follow as carefully as possible or as closely as possible to what I'm going to say. So you won't have to take very many notes. There may be some bits where you like to add notes, but only in certain cases. I'm talking about universal mind. And in Sanskrit, universal mind is Mahat, the great one. And although it's used in theosophical literature, or it is referred to, and is referred to in the secret doctrine, there is, as far as I know, no comprehensive treatment of the subject, and it is one that you have to pick up as you go along from various sources. Now, we saw in the last session on divine arithmetic and God geometrizes, that mind or intelligence must be there all the time in the process of the one life, the one reality, coming into manifestation. And the two functions that divine mind serves when it comes into manifestation, it of course produces consciousness, but as well as that, it produces the forms which are used, and it produces that is the growth pattern and the behavior. It produces the forms by means of growth pattern, and it produces behavior, which is a function of consciousness. Now, I started my thinking on this subject by watching birds which were being fed breadcrumbs on a lawn. I don't know if any of you have ever seen this, but it led me to think that we could understand the nature of universal mind by watching what happens in the world. Now, if those birds, they come down one by one, individually, and then you have a whole flock of them on the lawn eating the breadcrumbs. Suddenly there's a bang. And do you know what happens? Every one of those birds springs off the ground absolutely instantaneously and absolutely together. Now, when a horse race starts, some horses have a good start and some have a bad start. When the Olympics, when you have a race, some humans get away quickly and some slowly. Well, the other strange thing or interesting thing about birds is that occasionally some stay behind and only some of them go. And quite often, it's the birds of one species go, and the birds of another species stay behind. This set me thinking. Now, I also saw on television a flock of flamingos come in absolutely perfect arrowhead formation. And when they got close to the lake, they broke that formation and landed individually on a chosen spot. You've seen sheep. Sheep can act as a mob, completely as a mob, and do stupid things, as it were, and sort of under that mob control. But then, in other cases, they have their own leader, and they follow the leader. In other words, that leader is, as it were, directing the activities or behavior of the flock. Now, this led me to the conclusion that animals have a dual control of consciousness. And that dual control is, firstly, a control by an overriding intelligence. And I'll use that word because it's synonymous in my thinking to universal mind. There is an overriding intelligence which is controlling the flock, and then there are occasions when they act as individuals. If you watch any animals, and this you can all relate this to your own experience, all animals have individual characteristics. They act as individuals with pecking orders. Hens immediately, or soon, quite soon, have a pecking order. And the one who's the strongest gets the food first, and any other who tries to get the food is pecked and has to wait until something is left for him. And they have these individual characteristics. So I'm suggesting that this is a key to our understanding of universal mind, and I'm going to develop this as we go on. Now, this idea of group activity or group control or group consciousness in animals was, in the beginning of this century, explained by theosophical writers as the group soul. This term was not used by H.P. Blavatsky. And to my way of thinking, it's a rather nebulous concept and really does not explain anything. The soul, this is one way it was put, the soul of the animal goes back to a reservoir of soul stuff from which it came. All right, it's true, but it doesn't really explain much. And in First Principles, Sijana Rajadasa gives a definition of a group soul as a certain definite quantity of mental matter charged with the energy of the Logos. Now note that he says mental matter, because that comes into our studies further on. But charged with the energy of the Logos, there is nothing in the world which is not the energy of the Logos. Seems to me an extraordinary. It infers that matter is dead, and some charged with the energy of the Logos, which of course was the separative thinking that took place in those days. And C.W. Leadbeater, in the textbook of Theosophy, gives us what seems an oversimplified view of what he means by a group soul. A lion is not a permanently separate entity in the same way as man is. If man is a permanently separate entity, what about oneness? What about brotherhood? You know, it's not well put. He goes on to say, when the lion dies, that which has been the separate soul of him or it is poured back into the mass from which it came. A mass which at the same time is providing the souls for other lions. To such a mass we give the name group soul. To such a soul is attached a considerable number of lion bodies, let us say 100. Well, there's your simplified picture of a group soul. I don't think it's wrong, but it's badly expressed. There is no consideration of consciousness in those definitions. There's no consideration of shared consciousness. Now, HPB looked at it differently. She insisted that there are monads, sparks of the divine, separate focus, foci, at the atmic level. She insisted that there are monads within the life of everything, and explains the souls of animals in these terms. The monad in the stone, in the plant or animal, is ever divine like the human monad. Again, in the secret doctrine, the monad has to pass through the mineral, vegetable, and animal forms before the light of Logos is awakened in the animal man. The light of the Logos, of course, is causal consciousness, the development of what we used to call the egoic consciousness, but it's better to call it causal consciousness. She goes on again, the mineral monad is one, the higher animal and human monads are countless. The tendency to segregate into individual monads is gradual, and in the higher animals reaches almost to a point. Now, I like that concept. I didn't put it on the board, I should have. I like the concept of the if you do accept the group soul, I like the concept of a whole lot of, at the bottom of a pyramid. And at the bottom of the pyramid, you have one monad looking after a lot of units. Ants, for instance. I can't imagine one monad looking after each ant. I don't know. Just the way you look at it. But say you have all those ants looked after by a few monads, perhaps. And then when you get to the plants, you have, perhaps I'm going the wrong way around. Perhaps I should have started with the plants. You have one monad looking after a whole species of plants. Trees? I don't know. Trees have got a lot of individuality. You don't really know. But when you get up to the animals, then you have a smaller number of animals looked after by one group soul, until we get to domestic animals where you've got, say, two or three within that, at the top of the pyramid, with one monad looking after those. And then you get to a point in domestic animals where individuality is reached or nearly reached. And there again, we don't quite know when it actually happens. So I think that is the best way of looking at it. From the mineral, the monad looks after a countless number of units, and those numbers get less as life is expressed in the higher forms. So if we accept, as 8PB suggested, that the monad is involved throughout the whole evolutionary process, then we find in terms of consciousness that this involvement is subtle and diffuse in the mineral world, but becomes progressively more definite and focused in the higher forms of life. Now, is that clear? Then I'd like to ask about that. That's what we're basing the whole concept on. Yes?
Would you see any difference at all accepting the expression between the living doctrine and the...
No, I said it's not wrong, but a lot of considerations are not expressed in the group soul idea. I said consciousness is not expressed. It's this pouring back into a reservoir. To me, doesn't link up with consciousness. It doesn't link up with the monad. But that use of the word mental by Sijan Rajadasa helps. Now, perhaps... I just feel that the group soul concept is one that is not scientific. It doesn't help us in our expression of theosophy. We'll have this out in question time if you like. There is consciousness in every form, and to call it soul may be a misrepresentation. In an animal, of course, there is soul or self, but probably little sense of self. Although in higher animals, in the beginning, there is the beginnings of self-consciousness, which is the hallmark of human beings. And modern investigations reveal a very high level of intelligence in dolphins, apes, and they make us rather ashamed of the fact that we used to talk about them as dumb beasts. But modern thought suggests that group soul is a term that should be replaced. And it should be replaced in the theosophical literature, my way of thinking, by group intelligence. This concept was expressed by Hubert Perron, writing in The Theosophist in 1958. And it seems to me much more reasonable. Every group of animals, whether large or small, is dominated by an intelligence acting as a cohesive force whose task is to preserve at any cost the species in its charge. And in the Theosophist of May 1982, the General Secretary for Canada, Ted Davey, wrote a very good article covering the whole subject, which expressing the ideas that are those that seem to appeal to me anyway. I recommend that article to you, May 82 in The Theosophist. This suggests that every group of animals, plants, insects, or plants or insects, is guided by an intelligence within the universal mind, which uses a memory bank of physical experience. And it uses that memory bank of physical experience to protect a particular species over which it has guardianship. Have you watched a cat crossing the road? It just closes its eyes and goes like mad. Well, you see, I imagine in the days when there were only horse-drawn vehicles, that cat could go across, meander across, and it was fairly safe. But as the speed of cars increased, it got beyond its comprehension, and it thought the best thing to do was just to shut its eyes and go like mad. I think that this animal intelligence learns as it goes along. And the same thing is that the animals got used to the sound of a gun and react immediately if there's anything that sounds like a gun. But in the days of bows and arrows, of course, they didn't react that way. Now, the most interesting example of this is in the 100th monkey, the phenomenon. In the northern island of Japan, the scientists watched the monkeys there who ate as a staple food a sweet potato, which evidently got mixed with sand. Now, one young female monkey learned that by washing the potato in the sand, in a stream, the sand was washed off and it was much more palatable. 1958, I think this happened. Anyway, it was about this time of year. But this, when they watched this increase, and the young monkeys learnt the idea and taught their mothers, and it gradually spread. But after 2 or 3 years, there was a sudden explosion. And it was found that all the monkeys in that island were washing their potatoes in the stream. And the monkeys on the mainland started to do the same thing. Now, how else can you explain such a phenomena except by the concept of an overriding intelligence, which learns, which takes the experience of the one individual within the group and applies it to the experience of the whole? Do you have any other solutions? That, to me, is overriding intelligence within the divine mind. And this also explains the group, the dual consciousness, because when the animal tunes into that overriding intelligence, it acts in accordance with its ideas. When it switches off, it acts on its as an individual consciousness. The gift of self-consciousness in man has cut us off from this ability to tune in with the universal mind, which the intelligent aspect of nature. When we became self-conscious, lost that ability. In a way, it is a loss, because in some ways we feel inferior. We seem inferior to animals who reach a more universal consciousness, which is beyond human consciousness. Now, I'll give you some examples of that later on, but this leads us into the psychic field and the ability the animals have to contact a psychic field. But in The White Witch, a novel by Elizabeth Gould, there is this very beautiful quotation. Children and animals can soon forgive the blunderings of those humans who love them, but it is an extraordinary truth that a dog, in its utter ignorance of mind and soul, can see nearer to one than a human being who knows a little bit of both mind and soul and knows them wrong. Hence the statement that the more we know about human beings, the more we like animals. Right. Now we have seen, I'll go on to a little bit of the nitty-gritty stuff. not for long. We have seen how the divine will, Atma, within the duality of spirit and matter, plays through the one great energy field as separate vortices or separate foci, each with its unique note or vibratory pattern. And these are the monads. But these terms will be used later, I'm going to quote three major forces in the matter energy field. And they are Fohat, cosmic electricity, which is the builder. These come in later. It provides the building blocks, and it's the energizer within the world of matter energy. Prana, the vital energy, which is the conveyor of that energy throughout the world. It's the life sustainer. Prana, P-R-A-N-A. This is in your notes, actually, I think. And then Kundalini, the serpent fire, which is the sensitizer. Because it, rising from the earth, is that which develops consciousness. And later on, I'll go further into these as they crop up in the talk. But now, in the field of spirit or consciousness, in man, the microcosm, we have mind. And remember we said in the first talk that mind was that which links highest spirit, Atma, with lowest matter, the physical. In between that, the link is mind, and it's mind in which we work. Now, in the universe, the macrocosm, this link to my way of thinking is universal mind. And it also links Atma with the physical world. And the link is made through the positive planes. We'll talk about those next session. Through mind and sort of through the astral, but into the etheric. And it is the etheric world which produces the patterns which become physical objects and life forms. So we have Atma working through mind, reflecting itself down into the astro-mental and then into the etheric. And we'll study that later with the slide. Now at the causal level of higher mind, universal mind contains the archetypes of all that has been, is, or will be. And this, of course, links it with Akash, which stands behind universal mind, the memory of nature. From this source emanate the forms of all living things, physical objects, sensations, and thoughts. It also provides guidance for the growth and the behavior of living things. There are two aspects of mind, growth and behavior. Just before we go on, this aspect of universal mind, which contains the memory of all things, when reflected into the astro-mental, becomes what H.P. Blavatsky called the astral light. And to quote from her, it is the great crucible in which vile emanations of the earth, moral and physical, upon which the astral light is fed, are all converted into their subtlest essence and radiated back, intensified upon the earth, thus becoming the epidemics, moral, psychic, and physical. Now man feeds this astral light with his thought and feeling. And of course, it contains the whole memory of the past, which is pretty unpleasant in a lot of ways. And today, we are feeding into it all sorts of greedy and self-centered thoughts. And worse than that, we are playing around with this structure of nature, with genetic engineering, with hormone weed killers who increase the growth of a plant until it burns out its resources and dies, and so on. We're now tinkering with nature. To put it clearly, this is the way you can put it in a way that can be understood. When the universal mind reflects cosmic ideation, that's the ideal archetypal form, the astral light is created. But when it reflects man's semi-evolutionary past and his present-day selfishness and greed, it is destructive. Now, we're going to pass on to the next point, this which is up here on the board that John kindly put up for me. That is my little diagram down there. I'll show you that on the slide in a moment. But I'm told that I've done this anti-clockwise, completely without realizing it. It seemed to me that the way to start was from here. I don't know, I hope it doesn't matter. Anyway, you will all have heard the concept of life descending as monadic essence, it's sometimes called. I would just like to say it's the monadic light coming down, the path of outgoing. And then there is the path of return. Now, in the path of outgoing, many of these vile aspects of the astral light are used. A lot of the matter which is used to get vicarious experience by the descending light is that which is decaying. And violent feeling and strong feeling of all negative types give better experience to the life which is descending. So in a sense it uses that which is destructive. But at the point here you find that the old Sufi idea, the Sufi is the secret or esoteric side of the Muslim teaching, of the Islamic teaching, then you know, you've all heard it, but I've got to say it again, that life, when it reaches the mineral, sleeps in the mineral, all right? When it reaches the vegetable, it stirs in terms of consciousness. When it reaches the animal, it wakes in terms of consciousness. When it reaches man, a son of mind, because man comes from universal mind, then in man it reaches self-consciousness. Now let me deal with this little part up here first. Oh, there's something that John hasn't put on. You'll see it here. Can you see a sort of a strip there? Perhaps I'd better have the, we have the slides, John. I can show it to you on this. Now here you have the same thing, but you have this bit in here, which I think is tremendously important. Now, somewhere, self-consciousness starts to develop, probably in the higher animals. They certainly have consciousness. Whether it's self-consciousness is another matter, but it does appear to develop in the higher animals. Now, the sense of self and not self increases in man. At some point here, there's what in theosophy is called individualization. The monad, one monad per unit of consciousness, one monad per person. Now, I'm not sure that this takes place suddenly and something comes down from the cosmic world, it may, but to me, it's probably a fairly slow process. But it does take place somewhere here, and you then get a self-conscious entity. It's not supposed to take place in animals, but the development of self-consciousness starts there. Then you come up to a point here where you've got to start to lose the self-consciousness in the sense of a separate self that has been developed. That has to be lost because you're going back to unitive consciousness. Now, the point at which it starts
and probably higher even than that. When you enter the spiritual path back to the One, then you are fully responsible for your own actions and you are living in tune with the One life, and you've dedicated your life to the purpose of working in harmony with that One life. And so here it is pretty rapid. But you see what happens. This goes, this disappears. Because when you enter the stream, when you reach enlightenment, you are one with that, and you have no separate self there. But so this bit is all important, because it's in there that the work is done. Man, because he's self-conscious, has the power to decide whether he will work with evolution or against it. He has the power to affect matter, to bring about the spiritualization of matter, and he has the power to be a creator of form. Nothing else in the universe has that power, according to Madame Blavatsky. All right then, having got that, and this we'll talk about in more detail next session, having got that, what goes on in here? Well, the whole of the building of forms, except for that used by man, it does include that used by man. That's why this is dotted. Because the universal mind actually comes to here. It includes us. The only thing we have is that we've taken a bit of that universal mind and made it ours. Made it ours for the development of self-consciousness. Now in here we have all the other forms and a tremendous amount of life which is unseen to us. We only aware in our senses of the tip of the iceberg. So there we have all forms of life, animal, mineral, vegetable, and so on, but their consciousness is within the universal mind to a much greater extent, as would be explained about the birth. All right. Well, what also there are those which guide the evolutionary process. At this level, the archetypal level, the guidance is by what's called the creative hierarchies. And I won't go into that at the moment. Down here, the guidance is left to the nature spirits and the devas who watch the form, the development of the forms in the plant world, for instance, and in the animal world, and who guide, to some extent anyway, the development of the young, of the species and possibly the old. So we have here a whole number of agents, agents for the divine purpose, but those agents are not working as separate individuals. They are aware of the purpose, the evolutionary purpose, and work entirely in conjunction or in harmony with it. You see what I mean? That's why they are not creators in their own right. And it is said, I think, that all this life here, has to go through this process for it reaches the One. It's here that the work of evolution is done. Right. Now this is a standard theosophical diagram from man visible and invisible, and it explains much of what I've been saying. Here it doesn't actually show the descent, the next one does. That it shows in the mineral that consciousness reaches just to the beginning of the astral. In the vegetable, it only reaches up to the astral, possibly a little bit more. In the animal, it reaches up and just touches the mental. Now, this is the dividing point, the fourth subplane of the mental world. Above it is the higher and below the lower. In man, of course, we do come up to this point, and our higher mind is above that point. The spiritual touches right one from the lowest to the highest. Now, this diagram, I'm not sure where it came from, but it's a very standard one. It shows it better. You see, here is the mineral, and there's its link with the monad. There's the vegetable, and its link with the monad, animal, and the human. And here, in the descending arc, where the monadic life is coming back, there is still the link. Now, all that link below this point here, which is the division of the higher, well, in fact, that mantle, all this below there is within my way of thinking, within the universal mind. All this is within the universal mind. I should say, of course, that all this is within the universal mind, but here there is a degree of consciousness becoming progressively more self-conscious. And this life here is almost entirely within the universal mind and controlled by it. I haven't heard that said. It didn't happen later on. I think I'll have to visit out my notes and just go on. Now, one of the ways in which we can see this, do you remember? Let's just go back. To this one. Now we have the vegetable. Now the vegetable consciousness, according to the traditional theosophical teaching, only just touches the astral. If you remember that, it will help you in the rest of what I'm going to say. Now this is Steve Baxter, the American lie detector expert who experimented with plants. He connected his machine to a plant and found that he got an emotional response. Now, that emotional response, he got a rapport, he created a loving rapport with the plant. As it were, got in their consciousness fused. And he found that at a distance of 200 miles, that plant registered, because it was linked up to this lie detector machine, the needle of which went, when there was an emotional response, the needle clicked. At 200 miles away, when he missed the train and got a bit emotionally upset, this plant that was linked to him showed an emotional response. Now, Marcel Vogel, who I think has been to this school, am I right? Yeah. He did further investigation into this with children, and he found that he had to think of that plant as an equal in terms of consciousness before he got any response. This thinking of it as an equal is very interesting. Because, you see, the plant itself can only go up to the beginning of the astral. It hasn't got, according to our theosophical concept, any ability to act at the mental level or the higher emotional level. Now, there are several experiments which indicate an ability for plants to show mental behavior. One is the murder game. They had two plants. I think it was two. Doesn't have made them three. But they had two plants. Now, one, they were numbered, one and two, or A and B, and five people. Now, those five people were given a little slip of paper. And on one of those slips of paper was the instruction to pull out the plant from its pot and destroy it. Now, the people came in, and to the second plant, the one that was not going to be destroyed, it was linked to the lie detector machine. Well, when the people came in, the person with the instructions destroyed the plant, and then they went all past, and after a period,
the people came back in front of the plant that was not destroyed, but was connected to the lie detector machine, and there was an immediate response when the guilty person went in front of the other plant. Now that's mental activity. I'm going to suggest that's the activity not of the plant, but of the overriding intelligence behind it. There was another one. Professor Yamamoto in Japan actually got a plant to, by similar means, to add two and two and get four. Horses can do this, of course, and apes, but a plant doing it is quite unusual. Then you have another. You have a yogurt solution in one room and another solution exactly similar in another room. Now, that one of them is connected to this machine and the other isn't, but the one that is not connected is fed hot milk, which is a nutrient, and it likes it. And the emotional response in that is picked up by the yogurt solution next door. There's the community of consciousness between those two. Then you see, they're suggesting an overriding intelligence that links them. That is the apparatus which is used. Now, to carry this a little further, if you have two sets of plants and you produce or you radiate that with loving kindness, then it grows much better than that which is not radiated with loving kindness. And this radiation can be done through a photograph. The photograph appears to be able to contain in it, like the hologram, remember, the part contains the whole. The photograph appears to contain something in it which links with the overriding intelligence, the whole of that particular species, the archetypal perfection of that particular species. And there have been many cases during this, I don't want to spend too long, but this was done from a photograph. The photograph was irradiated from love. Those cabbages grew like that. Those who didn't have the loving intention stayed like that. Now, there was a case, I think, in America here. I think the man was Armstrong, who developed it's in the Life of Plants, Bird, Christopher Bird, and what's the other man's name? A Secret Life of Plants, where you had in a field of corn, a Japanese beetle, I think the disease was, and they took a photograph of that corn with one piece chopped off, one corner of the field, a photograph of the whole field, one corner chopped off, and they put on that photograph the insecticide which would kill that particular bug, and they irradiated that with their own thought power. And what happened? The bug was killed in the whole of the field, except for the corner which was cut off the photograph. And he put this on a commercial scale and sold it and was doing very well. The farmers thought this is a marvelous method of doing things. And then, of course, the big people got in and caused financial chaos, and the insecticide people got in, and he was forced out of business. But in there again, you see the archetypal pattern, the universal mind pattern of growth appears to be in the photograph. Now, this was done in England some years ago. It's a little old hat, I don't know much about it, but it still illustrates the points which I want to make. This is the Delaware camera. And this is the tuning of the Delaware camera. It started off with Abrams and Hieronymus here in America did the black Abrams was the black box, and Hieronymus carried on. And anyway, it's by a certain tuning. And the tuning is done, believe it or not, with the logarithmic spiral, which goes back to what I was saying in the last talk. Now, if the tuning is done to the sort of archetypal pattern of that particular plant, or the monadic note, if you like to look at it that way, then you can get life cycles produced on a photographic plate. Admittedly, there was a sensitive person doing it. I don't think that matters. The point is that the record was made. Here, the record from a lily seed of the bulb cycle, and here, the flower cycle. Both in probably at the etheric level. But remember, I said that the mental level, the thought level, is reflected into the etheric. And again, we have from a pilu of aconite. A pilu of aconite, which is a homeopathic remedy and has minimal amount of the sap of the aconite in it. From that, by tuning the instrument, they were able to get the flower. You see what I mean? The form, the growth form is there all the time if we can pick it up. This is holy water, which was blessed, and when it was tuned into by the machine, it produced that photograph. Now, I think we're getting near the end. This is another interesting one. I think we'll probably be able to stop here. And dynamolysis, this is called. This is in The Loom of Creation, a very interesting book. Now you have a system by which you make a solution of the sap of a chrysanthemum, and that is put in a container, and a wick is connected to a filter paper. Now the sap is drawn up through the wick into the filter paper where it spreads out. And it spreads out in the archetypal pattern of the flower. This has been done by many people. You can do it yourself, I think, if the instructions are in that book. But you see, to my way of thinking, that sap, the part, contains the pattern of the whole, the archetypal pattern of the flower, and it can be reproduced in simple methods like that. Now we'll leave it about now. I think we're about where I expect it to be.
Completely
normal and smart. It's not a PS publication. It's a big book, a lot of illustrations, and expensive, but extremely good. He's written a later book. I haven't got the title of this later book, but usually you find the first book of this type is the best. Then we have Fields of Force, I think that's the right term, by Winifred Duncan. I meant to look up in your library to see if it's there, but I'm sure it is. It was published by the PS, but some years ago, in the 50s, I think. It's a very good book. And not many books, as I said, cover this ground. Then there is Man, Moon, and Plant by Stratton, published by the TS and ADR during the war. And one chapter of that book was lost by enemy action, and unfortunately it's not complete, but it's a very good book. Some of you may know it. It's about the biological, the effects of the moon and so on the biological growth. And then there's this one, which comes into the field that I'm getting into now, Intelligence Comes First by Lester Smith. And the other one that's a good one is the Bendit's book. It used to be called Man Incarnate, but it's now called The Etheric Body of Man. And that will apply not only to this talk, but to the one on Thursday. There are other books, but those are the ones that I've got in mind at the moment. Now, The universal mind becomes enmeshed in the physical, has an effect upon the physical by means of the etheric double, as it's called in theosophical literature. There's very little about this in Powell's etheric double. He doesn't talk about the power of the etheric to produce or to send down, project growth patterns. It's in some of the other books. It's certainly in that Winifred Duncan book. So the etheric double is the same as what the Russians are calling the bioplasmic field, and it's the same as qi, which is the Chinese interpretation of it. It's that electromagnetic force. And actually, it can be measured by these instruments, like that which Baxter uses, because it is electromagnetic in its nature, and it is measurable in what they call microvolts, which of course is very low. And it is probably, according to Richard Silberstein and other writers, it is probably ionized matter. Ionized matter is that which has the ability to take on other atoms. It's, as it were, a free. Anyway, negative ionized matter is that which is the health-giving constituent in air, in the mountains, in the woods, at the seaside, and wherever there is sunlight and fresh, and it's fresh air. And you also get these negative ions where you get running water, especially waterfalls, and what's the other thing I've got here somewhere? You get it, of course, in sunlight. Now, the whole of the what I call prana in that first, the universal energy, actually comes from the sun. But it is absorbed, or it is put in a form that we can absorb it, through the food we eat. If it's got plenty of vitality, it's got plenty of prana. And fresh fruit and vegetables, of course, have more. And it's in the sunlight, it's in water. To swim in salt water is a very good thing. If it's clear water, then you get the vitality from it. And you can now get machines, have you seen them, that produce negative ions and stimulate the atmosphere around you to give you more energy. I've used them, but it's very hard to tell whether they work or not. But those machines are now available. So prana is the important thing when we're considering the etheric pattern of growth. Now, the etheric double, or the etheric pattern vehicle, has three main functions: to transmit patterns of growth from the archetypal mental world into the physical. It acts as a mold. It has the correct shape. In the seed is the correct shape of the tree that will be, and all the methods for it to become the tree. And the meaning of life, if you like, is that that seed becomes the most perfect tree it can, given the particular conditions in which it germinates. And that applies to all life, because all life strives to be as perfect physically anyway as possible. And the second work, the second function of the prana is to form a link with the superphysical, the astro-mental. And this is done, of course, through the endocrine glands and the force centers, which we're not going to talk about today because that applies more to man. And the third is to circulate energy throughout a biological system, to circulate the energy throughout the biological system. And in a human being, could we have the slides up? Thank you. We're going back. I'm sorry, I've got it upside down. Now, Rudolf Steiner has four etherics, which produce patterns of growth patterns of typical types. He calls them the warmth etheric, the chemical etheric, the light etheric, and the life etheric. And I've worked very hard to fit those in with what little we know or what little is given us in books like The Etheric Double. I haven't quite succeeded. But Milner and Smart in their book Loom of Creation give pictures which are obtained from just from water by much the same method. No, it's I haven't talked about Curie photograph, that comes next. But they put a plate down on top of another and an electric charge goes through. And under certain circumstances, it shows these basic shapes, the weighing out shapes. Now, there's a lot of work being done by the anthroposophists in this field. And some of it is in a book called Etheric Formative Forces, which I've seen. I can't find it in New Zealand. It is in the library at Tweetham. I don't know. It may be in this library. I haven't looked yet. Anyway, I won't go into those, but they're just interesting to note because those are made by photographs, not from anything at all. Just from water, I think it was. But we do get, when we get into the field of Curlian photographs, we have much the same thing. You have a high frequency force of electric force, which is played through electrodes between which is a photographic plate, and these, in this case a flower, are put on top or inside. I think it's probably inside. I've got diagrams, but it doesn't really matter. Anyway, this is a lensless form of photography, which may or may not show the etheric double. Now, the etheric double in man extends about an eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch outside him as a blue haze. Now, and it's probable that this is the discharge of the pranic forces that we take in. Because when we're in good health, that discharge goes straight out. When we're in bad health, it tends to sort of limp and fall down. And it gets... yes, it is the beginning of the halo, but the halo is more at the higher level, at the astromental level. But it's the same thing. But it, according to C.W. Leadbeater and others, it doesn't extend very far at the etheric level. Now, when you put the extra charge in by this machine, you can see the energy discharge, corona discharge it's called, round the outside. And when you, this is an actual Curlian photograph, which I was lucky enough to get. It's quite old now because I think he did his experimentation in the 50s. And you may have seen this on film. It's been showed on television as a film. And when you do, you see the energy shooting out like fireworks from this sprig of a plant. And all the time, energy is given off from a plant, this pranic energy, this etheric energy or chi. It's the same as you use in the acupuncture points. You see, it's the same thing, but that's within the body. And It's like a fireworks display when you see it actually in a moving film. Now there it is in a very good leaf, and you can see that it flows through all the veins and a very strong discharge on the outside. So whether this may reveal the, and a lot of scientists are arguing about that, including some of our own theosophical science. Never mind. This is the interesting one. This one was taken in Brazil. This is called the phantom leaf. And many efforts have been made to repeat this, with some success, but with a lot of failures. So, of course, the scientific world doesn't accept it. But you know that the body, for instance, has its etheric field, its etheric double, and if you have a limb amputated, it's said that you can feel that limb afterwards because the etheric is still there for a while, possibly years. Now, if you have a tooth pulled, you can feel the tooth afterwards. I've had that experience. I haven't had a limb amputated. It's interesting to see how long the etheric double stays with something. Now you know that a plant will wilt quite quickly if the temperature is hot. If it's put in water, it'll last longer. When it does lose the control by the monad, the atomic control, then the pattern of the etheric pattern breaks down and it dies. When we lose the etheric pattern, then chaos sets in and it dies. Now the interesting thing is timber. Timber retains its etheric pattern for a long, long time and lasts for hundreds of years, which is most interesting when you think into it. It will decay, it will rot, but under normal conditions it lasts for hundreds of years. Now this is the etheric of a body by the Curlian photograph of a maple leaf with the top torn off. And there you do see the pattern of the leaf after that part has been taken away. The etheric pattern still remains. And that is the growth pattern of the leaf. Now, sometimes it lasts a short time, sometimes longer. And also, of course, you see, we've always known that this pattern affects health. It's precipitated from the mental world down into the etheric. And you can see illness at the etheric level, which the Curlians did, and they impressed scientists from Moscow who brought down two leaves, one of which was diseased. And they found in one of the leaves something like this, which is a diseased spot. And they were able to tell the scientists which of the leaves was diseased. Incipient disease, that which will develop into physical disease later. Kilner, or his books called The Human Aura, it's still available. In the 1900s, early 1900s, the Harley Street specialist in London, he developed a screen with a coal tar dye, diocyanin in it, and through that, against a black curtain and certain conditions, he could see the human aura. He didn't or couldn't photograph it, but he did draw these diagrams. Now that's the normal human aura, which is goes out to the astromental layer. You see, there's several different layers, and I haven't been sure how to put those exactly into relation with the etheric, but the etheric normally, it's said, goes out only as an eighth or quarter of an inch, but after that, the aura goes further out into the higher etherics and the astromental. But he did see these dark patches and was able to diagnose disease. This woman had a hip disease when 2 years old, and that remained and showed up on the photograph. And she'd had several operations on the hip. And he also shows this, the energy from the etheric double, which will pass from one hand to another. And you all, if you go back to the days, your courting days, shall we say, can remember the energy that can flow from a male to a female hand, for instance. And that is the flow of the electromagnetic current, which is etheric in its nature. Oh, have we got last one? Oh, there's one missed out there. I wonder if I can get it. Can you get it, John? It must have stuck. If it's too much trouble, we'll wrap up. That's the one I want. Now, this, most of the Kirlian photographs were taken of fingertips, because you see, as we've shown, the etheric actually is discharged through the finger at a greater extent or more in a more concentrated way than normally. It doesn't matter. Shall I try the right for me to go on? Yeah, that's all right. Now, that's a normal discharge from a fingertip. But, of course, it's a little more than it would normally be because it's intensified by a high-voltage electric current. Oh. Some of the slides are opening up a bit and they stick in the machine. Not quite old. Now, this one is a fingertip that has tension shown in it. You see the pink and the colored bit means that there's something wrong emotionally. Remember I said that the one of the functions of the etheric was to link with the astromental, with the thought feeling. And tension shows up in these fingertips. I don't care what you say about whether the Kirlian photographs show the etheric double or not. What is important is that they can show astromental conditions, conditions of tension and thought conditions and feeling conditions. And that to me is very important. There's one in meditation, deep meditation. The fingertip has that very beautiful, even, strong, exactly what you would expect. And this is another one. This is a concert pianist. Before she goes on the stage, there is tension in her fingertips, the red, and when she's finished her performance, they are calm, with only a touch of the red remaining. So the Kirlian photographs do show the effect that you would expect the etheric double to show. That was one of the ones that you glued together. Anyway, this is the cell. Now, the cell is most interesting because it has its own overriding control. The cells of the body or any biological form are independent of its consciousness. They, according to Sijan Rajadasa, are on that involutionary arc. They're coming into life to experience. But on the other hand, it's like a universe. It's a tremendously complex thing. And there are millions, probably billions of them in the human body. And they each have a consciousness of their own. They have an outside which can take in, sort of sucks in, opens up and sucks in protein, and then they have the storage places in between, and in the center here they have the nucleus, which is the sort of the control room for the whole of the cell. And so the whole of our bodies have their own life, which is patterned by the universal oversoul, the universal mind, and they form the body according to that pattern for the particular species, human in this case. And a cell functioning in the liver has the ability to transfer its function to the heart. This is a staggering thought. It's got built into it a program for the whole of the body. And this applies to plants and everything else that has cell structure. I don't think I want to go into this too much, though. What I'm thinking. Oh, yeah. This one, too. The next one shows the control patterns. This is the control pattern within the cell. Incidentally, the cell has messengers called enzymes, which are carried throughout the bloodstream, throughout the whole body, and carry messages from one cell to another. I find these things extremely interesting because they're the way in which the universal mind works out. And the actual programming, the computer appears to be in the DNA and the RNA, which with the genetic factors, the zygotes and the chromosomes and genes, I got into trouble once trying to go into these, so I won't today, is that which causes the pattern of growth to conform to a particular species, which is very interesting indeed, but you have to be a bit technical to talk to an audience like mine tonight. But this I found, I'm sorry, everybody's seen, when I've shown this slide before, gets very upset by this, but you'll have to forgive me for showing something that is a bit of a section, that sort of thing, using animals. But this is a cockroach which has had its head removed. Now, when its head is removed, it can only act in certain ways. It does not react to sunshine or external conditions and tends to sort of go around in circles, but it's still alive. Now, when you take another cockroach and connect its blood supply here, then this cockroach can act normally. It's a rather horrible idea. But the point is that in that cockroach is at the endocrine gland, the pituitary. Now we know that in man, the pituitary is the link with the superphysical world. And it is that that gives us consciousness, really, from the higher levels of mind. And it also, in the human body, controls the functions in most of the body. So here we find that insects require pituitary glands to bring through the pattern from the universal mind. And I, until I saw this, didn't realize that this was necessary. But the cockroach, the little cockroach, has a pituitary gland which allows it to link with the superphysical, which to my way of thinking is the overriding universal control. And there's the gland, the pituitary gland. In the human beings, of course, in the brain, in the third ventricle of the brain. I won't go into that. Now, we're getting to the third field. This is the concept that there is a universal field, electromagnetic or possibly mental, which controls the behavior of all animals as groups. It's the group mind. The group soul. This was taken in New Zealand, it came from a photograph in the newspaper. These are whales, small whales, and that particular time 300 of them came ashore in a bay, in a harbour. And it's happening, of course, all over the world. Now, the amazing thing is, why does it happen? And the difficulty there is in getting them to go out to sea when it does happen. In this case, I think all of them lost their lives. But there was another case recently in New Zealand where they actually towed some of the whales. I think they were the killer whales, towed them out to sea, and some of them escaped. But they seem to have a pattern of wanting to go in a particular direction. Possibly it's a pattern from back in their earlier life. They might have been water right through here, and they followed that migratory pattern. But we have to sort of presume that there Oh, and what happens is one of them gets in shallow water and into trouble, and the whole of the rest of them come in to try and help it. And they get stranded, and the tide goes out, and they dry up, and they die. Nobody, no scientist has given a complete or acceptable answer for the phenomena. The lemmings is another phenomena that's exactly the same. This one is an answer. It's all right, I think, John, if you can get slightly focused. There have been books written about mysterious time clocks, which is the same thing. In animals, you get the ability to act to a particular time of the day or particular time of the month or the year. And how does it happen? The scientists suggest it's by linking with the stars and the moon and the sun and so on. But remember, go back to that earlier diagram, and the intelligence in the plant or in the lower animal only just touches the astral. Doesn't reach the mental. So it seems to me that there is an overriding force field throughout the whole of the world which is used to guide birds and animals in their migratory paths and to tell them when it's the correct time to do to mate and have young and so on. And when the caribou leave the Arctic and come down, they do it at exactly the right time. They get caught by freak weather sometimes. Now, the best known cases, oysters in Connecticut are from the coast, were taken in a sealed container to some Evanstown in Illinois. Now, they opened on the normal in the coast under normal conditions at a certain time of the tide. When they were taken to Evanstown, they went on opening at that same rhythm. But gradually, after a few weeks, they changed the rhythm to conform to a rhythm imposed by tides if there had been tides at Evanstown inland. Because you know the tides vary in different parts of the world. Now, this, of course, seems to indicate that there is an overriding intelligence which adjusted that rhythm. And there are other cases. These were bees. These were bees which were taken evidently from France right across the Atlantic in a sealed container. Now the containers they use are sealed against electrical and electromagnetic static electricity. They're sealed against noise and they're sealed against light. But the pattern, the behavior pattern, doesn't seem to be affected. In other words, these bees were taken right across there and they carried on the pattern of behavior according to the sunlight that was established here. And in the course, there must be about 4 or 5 hours difference. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6 hours difference. They carried on the pattern of the sun in France here. But when they were released into the open, they gradually went back to the proper pattern of the sunlight in the USA. And all this, the same concept of an overriding force field will help you to understand dowsing. And in fact, it may be the same level. It's part of the universal mind. Must be. It may be the same level that is used in telepathy. And the last one is the Grunions, which on the Californian coast here come up in thousands at a certain day of the year, a new moon or a full moon, and they know exactly when the right time is to come. They lay their eggs at the very high spring tide, and then they go back to the sea, and a month later, at the next high tide, the eggs are by that time are hatching and are washed back into the sea. But you see, here it seems to me there is an overriding intelligence guiding all those fish to act exactly at the right time. I think that's the last one.